I'd like now to welcome Jeffrey Harrison. He's an award-winning poet, author of 5 books of poetry, the latest of which is Into Daylight. He will be speaking here in Santa Fe as part of the Muse Times 2 poetry series, along with poet Nick DeBascal, on Sunday, the 1st of March at 4 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.
So I've been reading your book of poetry with great interest and reading it aloud and thinking about it, and I was wondering if maybe to start off we could have you read a poem.
That sounds great. I'll start with this poem, Renewal, which is sort of in the middle of my newest book. It's about going to the Department of Motor Vehicles. Renewal. At the Department of Motor Vehicles to renew my driver's license, I had to wait 2 hours on one of those wooden benches, like pews in the Church of Latter-day Meaninglessness, where there is no stained glass, no windows at all, in fact, no incense other than stale cigarette smoke emanating from the clothes of those around me, and no sermon, just an automated female voice calling numbers over a loudspeaker. And one by one, the members of our sorry congregation shuffled meekly up to the pitted altar to have our vision tested or to seek redemption for whatever wrong turn we'd taken, or pay indulgences, or else be turned away as unworthy of piloting our own journey. But when I paused to look around, using my numbered ticket as a bookmark, it was as if the dim fluorescent light had been transformed to incandescence. The face of the Latino guy in a ripped black sweatshirt glowed with health, and I could tell that the sulking white girl, accompanied by her mother, was brimming with secret excitement to be getting her first license, already speeding down the highway, alone, with all the windows open, singing.
Poet Jeffrey Harrison, and one of the things I really liked about that poem was, first I saw the title, Renewal, and I thought, oh, the spring and the new buds. And then it's about the driver's license renewal, and it's like, okay, we're back down to earth.
Yeah.
And then it turns into a kind of beautiful, almost spring-like thing with this girl going through a kind of coming of age. I just love the play on that word, renewal.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I mean, it does end up being both of those things, I guess, both of those interpretations of the word renewal. I did have a long time in the DMV to think about things, but this poem actually took a long time to write. There was an early version that was longer that sort of petered out. And then I put it aside for a couple years and went back to it and found another way into it and ended up getting to that place where the poem arrives with the girl driving down the road singing.
When you get to that place where the poem arrives, is there a moment where you know you're done?
Well, that's a little hard. I mean, sometimes there's a feeling that you've hit something and that you've gotten somewhere that you didn't know you were going to get to. That's always the best feeling. I like to not know where I'm going when I write a poem, which is why, you know, they can peter out and sort of stall out and not go anywhere. But if you don't really know where you're going, then you can get somewhere that you didn't know you were going to get to, and that's always maybe the best feeling you can have writing a poem. On the other hand, you're never sure when a poem is finished. What the French poet Paul Valéry said about a poem never being finished, only abandoned, is unfortunately true a lot of the time. Sometimes it takes your poet friends to help you figure out if you've gotten to the right ending. Endings are hard. Sometimes I'll write dozens of endings for a single poem before figuring out that which one works.
We spoke once on this show to the author Sherman Alexie, and I asked him a similar question, like, how do you know when you're done? And he just said, the publisher's deadline.
Yeah, that is one way of looking at it. But, I mean, most poets don't work with a deadline. It's very open-ended, so you can sort of torture yourself forever about whether you've got the poem right yet.
Would you like to read another poem?
Sure. There's one called The Day Nothing Happened, which is... it's a little bit different. It's more historical, and it's light. I heard this thing on I think it was on NPR, about how British computer scientists had somehow figured out that April 11th, 1954 was the most boring day of the 20th century. that kind of triggered this poem. I had to do a little research. Usually, you know, poems don't involve a lot of research, lyric poems, but this one was about that specific day, so I had to do a little bit. The day nothing happened. On that day in history, history took a day off. Current events were uneventful. Breaking news never broke. Nobody of any import was born or died. If you were born that day, bask in the inverted glory of your unimportance. No milestones, no disasters. The most significant thing going on was a golf tournament, the Masters. It was a Sunday. In Washington, President Eisenhower, whose very name induces sleep, practiced his putt on the carpet of the Oval Office, a little white ball crossing and recrossing the presidential seal like one of Jupiter's moons or a hypnotist's watch. On the radio, Perry Como was putting everyone into a coma. But the very next day in New York City, Bill Haley and his Comets recorded Rock Around the Clock, and a few young people began to regain consciousness, while history, like Polyphemus, waking from a one-day slumber, stumbled out of his cave, blinked his giant eye, and peered around for something to destroy.
We're talking to poet Jeffrey Harrison. The poems are quite different and use different forms and kind of different modes of expression, but a lot of them are narratives. They feel like narratives from your life. I don't know whether they're all true or sort of semi-fictionalized. I don't even know if you call it that in poetry. But in these narratives, there were times, I read a lot of them aloud last night, and there's so much emotion that I felt like you didn't express overtly because there was no sentimentality in them. There wasn't a kind of like dripping emotion, and yet there was moments where I was speechless or wanted to cry, even though it wasn't overtly sad.
Yeah, putting something into words is a form of transformation, but maybe sometimes you don't need to do that much more. It depends on the poem, but you don't need to push it. You want to push it into the imagination in unusual ways and surprising ways, but you don't want to push the emotion too hard because the emotion usually comes through anyway. And what you said about narrative is interesting. I mean, I think of my poems as somewhere between lyric and narrative, you know, where narrative obviously is telling a story and lyric is more musical, more personal, and instead of telling a story of moments over time, it's usually about one moment. But really, you can think of that as a spectrum with pure lyric at one end and maybe chronological straight narrative at the other end. And most of the poems that I write are somewhere shifting along that spectrum. So some are a little bit more lyrical and some are a little bit more narrative, but they all have elements of both, I think. And the other thing is when you put them together in a book, you know, I don't write them in the order that they end up in the book, but I try to find an order that works, a certain arc. So there is kind of an intermittent narrative of the way the book works itself. And maybe with this book, I mean, just to put it in perspective a little bit, the book as a whole, and you discover this as you go along, but my last book was called Incomplete Knowledge, and it had two sections. You know, it was broken in half, and the first half had a lot of poems. Some of them were funny, some of them were, you know, it was a variety, but the whole second half was about my brother's suicide. So it took a very dark turn in that half, and I felt very complicated about those poems. And then this book has a few poems about my brother, but mostly I would say this book is about trying to reconnect with the world during the decade after his death. So there's some poems that touch on his death, but there are many others that are about other things. But in a general sense, I would say they're kind of about re-engaging with the world and with poetry.
Would you like to read the poem Walking with Eliza?
Sure. Walking with Eliza. Late morning, mid-October, Eliza and I walk through the woods, the dog trotting ahead one minute, then dawdling behind us to sniff some pungent clump of damp leaves before catching up with the two of us again. We've both had birthdays this month, 50 for me, a milestone I'm not sure what to make of, for her 14, a humbler number marking a transformation more tangible. Her tomboy phase finally over, the baseball cap she wore backwards every day now hanging on a hook in her bedroom, already a relic, her thick hair grown out, her body taller, balancing between childhood and the exciting, slightly frightening unknown of what comes next. But for now, she's collecting leaves, the yellow mittens of the sassafras, the burgundy oaks, the lemony ovals of the beeches baking to brown, and the maple's red flamelets scattered on the path, their backs a pale violet. She says she likes the maples best, reminding me of the time some 15 years ago when I said something like that to a friend from out west who scolded me for having a proprietary attitude toward nature. I don't recount that story for Eliza, but instead say something about how funny it is that we talk in a way that makes value judgments about nature, even though we know one thing isn't better than another. She agrees and adds, "I like the other leaves too." Maybe that's what I should have said to my friend. So simple. I comment on how strange the weather is, as if the day can't decide whether it wants to rain or be sunny. And then on how funny it is that we say things like that, as if the day had feelings. I ask her if they've talked about this in English class, and she says, "You mean personification?" And I say, yeah, deciding to spare her the term pathetic fallacy, another rule about how we're supposed to think, a censoring of the imagination. I'm balancing between my fatherly instinct to teach her and my delight in the fresh way she sees things, grateful to have her with me to keep me from being weighed down by my own thoughts like these rocks half buried in the trail. They're beaded with moisture, and I say this must have something to do with the way the day is both humid and cool. Eliza says, "I'd like to think they're sweating," and I laugh and say, "Personification again," and talk about the difference between rational and magical thinking, and how it's funny that I, a poet, gave the scientific explanation, though I prefer to see it the other way, or maybe both ways at once. Because, after all, we're both Libras, always weighing both sides of everything. For instance, the ways she is like me and the ways she isn't. And how I want her to stay as light as the bag of leaves she's carrying, but no, she won't be able to forever. And the two of us continue walking together, years apart but right next to each other, dropping bits of conversation onto one side of the scale or the other. Talking about this and that, pausing to call the dog.
Poet Jeffrey Harrison, one of the things that really struck me about that poem, besides the fact that one can so clearly hear the voice of this 14-year-old girl, your daughter, is that kind of thinking about the scientific explanation and the poetic truth, the rational and the magical thinking. Does that enter your mind a lot when you're writing?
In a certain way, poetry is trying to get at the magical thinking, I think. But we're also rational beings, and we're trying to make sense of things. So I think they're both there. You're balancing both of them. And the other thing in this poem that I was noticing while I was reading it is that there's a sort of an internal meditation going on with the speaker, you know, i.e. me. And there are the things that he's thinking but not saying. And they're the things that he's saying in the conversation. So it's, you know, it ends up being both sort of a meditative poem and a narrative or conversational poem.
Yeah. There is a whole body of work, as you mentioned, about your brother whom you lost, and his death was a suicide. And there's a number of poems in this book about that. And I was wondering if you could read one of them. But I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what the process is like of writing when you're writing about something that is probably too painful to really be put into words or summed up by words or put to rest by words.
Yeah. I mentioned that the second half of my last book, Incomplete Knowledge, was all about pretty much the immediate aftermath of my brother's suicide. And those poems were very difficult to write. but I just had to write them. I mean, that's what I do. I couldn't really ignore that. It was such a huge subject that what I ended up doing, almost without knowing it, was isolating different moments in that book, like the moment we found out, the moment the suicide note came through the fax machine because it was faxed by the detective or the coroner. I can't remember which, but that kind of thing. And then I wrote more of them. But the big difference between those poems and a lot of poems that poets write is that, well, Wordsworth talked about poetry being emotion recollected in tranquility. So that's usually after the fact. You know, you're recollecting it. But really, with something as big as a suicide, I was really writing from inside it. So there was a certain amount of disorientation even on my part. And maybe it doesn't come through in the poems. I'm never really sure of those poems. But one thing about that book is I worried that some of those poems were too much about my brother's death and not that much about him and what he was actually like, because especially with a suicide, that can kind of take over. So I had a lot of mixed feelings and doubts about the way those poems came across. But a few in this book, one or two in this book, and there really only are a few about my brother's death in this book, but one or two of them I felt like I finally maybe captured a little bit of what he was actually like, and the whole thing wasn't overwhelmed by his death. So I could read one of those, maybe.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, the one that comes to mind is called Encounter with John Malkovich. Just to set it up a little bit, my brother was really sort of into Malkovich. My brother was a quirky guy and very funny, very tender and mild, but also quirky. And he really loved Malkovich's first movie, which a lot of people haven't seen because it's not on DVD. It's a movie of Sam Shepard's True West. It was really almost like a filmed play. But we would watch that a lot, especially when we all came to my parents' house for Christmas. So that comes up. So that's really the background. And then the fact that I saw Malkovich in a record store in Cambridge, Massachusetts. That was the trigger for the poem. Encounter with John Malkovich. When I spot him in Tower Records two aisles over, flipping through bins of discounted CDs at their going out of business sale, his shaven head half covered by the hood of his gray sweatshirt, my first thought is I want to tell my brother, but my brother is dead. And yet I watch him furtively, searching for some Malkovichian quirk, some tick that might make Andy laugh. But he isn't giving anything away besides his slightly awkward stoop over the racks. Then it comes to me that if I can't tell my brother about John Malkovich, I can tell John Malkovich about my brother, and my heart starts pounding. Normally, I don't believe in pestering celebrities, but there are exceptions. If Spalding Gray walked in right now, I would definitely talk to him. But that's impossible, since he, like my brother, though under very different circumstances, killed himself. But John Malkovich is alive and standing right over there, and my mind is racing ahead to the two of us leaving the record store together, then having coffee at a nearby diner, where I am already telling him how my brother was obsessed with the movie of Sam Shepard's True West, and especially with him, John Malkovich, playing Lee, the older of two brothers. How Andy, who was my older brother, loved to imitate Malkovich, or rather Lee, everything from his small, off-kilter mannerisms to his most feral outbursts, but even then he'd be smiling, unable to hide his delight. And how every Christmas he brought the video to our parents' house in Ohio, and our parents would groan when they walked through the room and sigh, "Not this again," or call it the most un-Christmassy movie ever made. Which is probably true, but for us, him and me, our other brother and our sister, but especially him, you'd have to say it was our It's a Wonderful Life. And I have to tell him how Andy used to cue the tape up and ask, "Can we just watch this one scene before whatever it was we were about to do, go out for dinner or visit our demented grandmother?" And we'd watch him, John Malkovich, standing on a chair, shouting pronouncements or destroying a typewriter with a golf club. and we'd go off laughing and exhilarated to our appointed errand, his inflections ringing in our ears. But now it's something about the way he thoughtfully considers his purchases, shuffling through them, then putting one back, reconsidering, his hand hesitating over the bins, that somehow reminds me of Andy and makes me certain Malkovich would be interested in him. A sympathetic character, if there ever was one, funny, gentle, a lover of dogs and kids who had neither. With an odd sense of humor and some mostly unobtrusive symptoms of obsessive-compulsive disorder, who, like Lee, but to a much lesser degree, or so we thought, had trouble placing himself in the world. A part I'm certain Malkovich could play, all of it coming full circle, Malkovich playing Andy, playing Malkovich playing Lee, or just Malkovich playing Andy, bringing him back to life the way Lee suddenly springs back up at the end of the movie, alive after all, menacing as death, the phone cord still wrapped around his neck. It turns out that John Malkovich and I do leave the store together. We check out at the same time, two registers apart, then head for the door. The moment coming to a peak for me as I realize my last chance is about to slip away. But Malkovich, in front of me, has to wait there while a stream of people coming in briefly blocks his exit, and I watch, in profile, his flurry of impatient blinking. Or is it a display of exaggerated patience? Each blink counting off the seconds he is forced to wait, or the number of customers going by him, not recognizing him, it seems to me, though his hood is down by now. And I think, this is it. This little fit of blinking is the thing Andy would delight in most, the one detail he would rewind the tape to see again.
Poet Jeffrey Harrison, and I have to say, if what you were hoping to do was let us get to know your brother, I feel like it's succeeded in that very much.
Oh, good. Well, thank you. I'm glad. Glad to hear that.
I think what I was trying to get at before was this question of, I mean, so many people at this point in history who are not professional writers see writing as a kind of therapeutic process. And for you, engaged as an artist, engaged in craft and engaged in living and suffering and being joyful and all the things that the rest of us are doing, but perhaps even more consciously or to a greater degree, because that's the essence of your work. Is there a therapeutic aspect to writing?
Yeah, the relationship between therapy and poetry is pretty complicated. I don't think it's like a one-to-one correspondence that's easy to describe or categorize. So when people ask me, do you think it helped you to write all the poems about your brother's death, I'm not sure if it did or it didn't. I think it must have in some ways, but it's not entirely clear. I mean, in some ways, it kept me in it much longer. I mean, inside his death, I don't know if that's good or not. In terms of whether they can help other people who have gone through some kind of suffering, I mean, I hope they can in some way. And some people say that they have, so that's always gratifying. But I don't think that's, I mean, I don't know. It's hard to describe. It's not all they're doing. It's not, the reason for being is sort of that I had to write them. They came out of my life, but exactly what the effect on my life has been is hard to say. I'm glad I wrote them. I was glad that other people were glad that I wrote them. I was worried a little bit about family members. So I guess I can't really answer that question. I can just sort of talk around it.
How do you deal with the fact that you are writing about people who are close to you and they are eventually going to read it? Does that affect how you write? Are there things you choose not to write because of the other person's privacy?
Well, I mean, that's complicated too. Usually I would write it anyway. I learned early on writing poems about my relationship with my father, which wasn't always good when I was, you know, a teenager, and I wrote a little bit about that. You don't really need to show the person the poem unless it gets published. So that's when you have to sort of maybe tell the person about it, warn them. But if you write a sort of a scathing poem about someone and you don't publish it, you don't really have to let them know. So it is a little complicated. With the poems about my brother, especially in my last book, I was very worried what my mother was going to think. But she was very supportive and she loved the poems, so I was glad about that.
One of the things we haven't talked about so much, but that's very present in your book, is the fact that you are observing nature a lot. You're outdoors a lot. There's a great dog that goes with you in some of these poems and in different ways. And nature is both, a set of metaphors, I guess, or sometimes not, but very much the kind of breath in much of your work. Do you actually write outdoors?
Sometimes. I mean, sometimes I do, if the weather's good. And I do go to the Adirondacks in the summer sometimes, and I do some writing up there, and you're very close to nature up there. And it's interesting. I've always written about nature. You know, my very first book, which came out in 1988, had a lot of nature poems in it. I don't really object to that term the way some people do, but as you live your life, more happens to you. You sort of accumulate experience, and maybe the way you write about nature changes a little bit anyway as you get older. I feel like now, like the poems in this book, it's less like I'm here and nature's over there and I'm writing about it. It's more me in nature, sort of as an active player, sort of meditating about it and other things while walking through it. So I think there's sort of an added dimensionality maybe in the newer poems about nature.
When you say that nature poetry is a term that some people object to, what do you mean by that?
The poetry world is complicated. I mean, there's just so many kinds of poetry being written right now. But, I mean, I understand why people object to that term, nature poetry. It's because they feel it's reductive. Whereas, really, if the poem is about nature, there's usually something else going on, too, like either metaphorically or some other dimension. So people don't want their poems to be reduced to that. But I think people understand that there's more going on in what might be called a nature poem, usually.
Jeffrey Harrison, it's almost time to go, but I was wondering if you might want to read one more poem before we go.
That would be great. This sort of follows from our discussion of nature poetry. This is the last poem in my new book, Into Daylight, and it's a little unusual, I would say, for a nature poem. It's a poem about flowers and trying to transplant them from the Adirondacks to Massachusetts, where I live, but it takes on some unusual metaphors and references as it goes. It's called Cross-Fertilization. It's come to this. I'm helping flowers have sex, crouching down on one knee to insert a Q-tip into one freckled foxglove bell after another, without any clue as to what I'm doing, which, come to think of it, is always true the first time with sex. And soon Randy Newman's early song, Maybe I'm Doing It Wrong, is running through my head as I fumble and probe, golden pollen tumbling off the swab. I transported these foxgloves from upstate New York, where they grow wild, to our backyard in Massachusetts, and I want them to multiply, but the bumblebees, their main pollinators, haven't found them, and I'm not waiting around. The only diagram I found online portrayed a flower in cross-section, the stamens extending the loaded anthers toward the flared opening. But the text explained the female sexual organs are hidden. Of course they are. Which leaves me in the dark, transported back to a state of awkward, if ardent, unenlightenment, a complete beginner figuring it out as I go along, giggling a little and humming an old song as I stick the Q-tip into another flower, as if to light the pilot of a gas stove with a kitchen match, leaning in to listen for the small, quick gasp that comes when the flame makes contact with the source.
Jeffrey Harrison, is the author of 5 books of poetry. He's reading from his latest book, Into Daylight. And once again, he will be speaking here in Santa Fe as part of the Muse Times 2 poetry series, along with poet Nick DePascal, this coming Sunday, the 1st of March at 4 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore. Jeffrey Harrison, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me.